Welcome to episode 20 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at UNC Charlotte. And today I've got with me Dave Cooperi. Am I pronouncing that right? Cooperi.
It's Cooperi, but pronounces it 12 different ways, so don't worry.
Oh, okay. He is assistant professor of political science and public policy at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. He's done work on U.S.-Latin American relations, but you sit at the intersection of IR and comparative politics. I think it's pretty clear from what you do. He also just published an article about anti-Americanism in a special issue of the Latin Americanist. So particularly if you are if you're an academic interested in Latin America, then go check that out. So, Dave, thank you for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me.
I've started asking everybody the same question, which actually has ended up pretty interesting, and that is, what got you interested in studying Latin American politics?
Well, I've always been interested in geography, foreign cultures, and foreign affairs as a young age. And so, for example, I remember sitting in my parents' closet as a young kid, reading through all their stacks of National Geographic magazines. But I mean, I can still remember some of the articles and pictures. But my interest in Latin America in particular sort of happened by chance. So heading to college, I knew I wanted to study abroad. I wanted to study international affairs. And I was studying Spanish. So I thought that meant the logical choice for me was to go to Spain, because obviously you go to Europe to study abroad. But my school had a great program in Merida, Mexico, and that ended up working well with my schedule and budget. And when I headed down there, I'd never spent a night outside the U.S., but I fell in love with the local culture immediately and quickly became fascinated by the country's tumultuous history, politics, relations with the U.S. I went back the next year for an internship, and then back again the next year for a post-graduation road trip with a friend. And these experiences in Mexico motivated me to pay more attention to the rest of the region, and I ended up applying for a fellowship to complete graduate studies in South America and really immerse myself, and I ended up in Ecuador. And in Ecuador, I was prompted with new questions about political instability, identity politics, Latin American integration, relations with the U.S. I was doing a master's in diplomacy and was basically trained to be an Ecuadorian diplomat. And so I was the only non-Latino student, so everyone bombarded me with questions about the U.S., and I quickly recognized the formative space given to all things U.S. in the region's international affairs, and wanted to study it further when I started a PhD program.
Okay. So, I mean, and actually a lot of people have this sort of just one thing happens, another thing happens, and another thing happens. It's not always a straight line.
Yeah, totally.
And actually, I was one of the people who chose Spain. I studied in Madrid because I thought, okay, yeah, I want to go to Spain. And then actually by chance then, all my interest kind of led back to Latin America.
Yeah, that's fun.
Okay, so coming back to your research in particular, I feel like we tend to assume that public opinion in Latin America is pretty negative toward the U.S. Would you agree that we, meaning sort of the U.S. public, tends to think that, even though now, like you've argued, there's quite a bit of evidence to the contrary? So would you agree with that, and why do you think that's the case?
I mean, I think that assumption is pretty common among Latin American watchers and students of Latin American studies, for example, within the West. And my interpretation is that assumption responds to two factors. First, it's a recognition that the U.S. has a history of foreign policy sins in the region, right? From dollar diplomacy to Cold War interventionism to imperfect handlings of the coup in Venezuela in 2002 and more recently in Honduras. But second, the region has produced very visible and vocal critics of the U.S., both politicians like Hugo Chavez of the world, Evo Morales, and writers and other intellectuals. And so those of us who pay attention to the region, study its history, politics, read a bit of literature, we come across both motive for resentment and then high-profile examples of that resentment. So it's just a quick step to assume this negativity is the norm.
And but as you've shown, that's a pretty problematic assumption. And one thing that your article made me think about was the complexity of the concept of anti-Americanism in the first place. So, you know, how do you think, given the fact that really a lot of people base this on the history, but then sometimes the very high-profile examples of it, how do you think we can usefully define anti-American or anti-Americanism?
Yeah, that's a challenge. I like to start with a straightforward definition that comes from Katzenstein and Cohen. They wrote a 2000 book on anti-Americanism. They define it as a psychological tendency to hold negative views of the United States. So It's pretty simple, and I like it because it suggests that views can fall on a continuum from strongly negative to strongly positive, anything in between. And it also allows for ambivalence, which I find is a defining characteristic of many people's views, not just of the U.S., but many other political actors. So I like the flexibility of this definition, but I also think it's useful in the face of this sort of continuum of often ambivalent views for us to be as precise as possible with the operationalization of the concept when we do conduct research. So, you know, distinguish between whether what we're talking about is or getting at is one's general views of the U.S. based on their strongest associations or more specific attitudes towards, say, a U.S. foreign policy or immigration policy or pop culture. And there's some survey data out there from Pew and LaPop, for example, that allows us to have that level of specificity. And so I tried to contribute to that as well. I did field work in Ecuador. I did a nationally representative survey there and combined some open-ended questions with these more closed-ended general questions to get at what people's strongest associations are and what most positive and negative views of the U.S. are and try to flesh out the concept further. And so I really like the mixed methods approach because I'm not satisfied with just the one single general question if we're going to talk about something as complex as anti-Americanism.
You know, one interesting thing, too, about that definition is the idea that that somebody could hold negative views of the United States, yet the term that we use to describe that is anti-Americanism as opposed to anti-U.S. policy. And I always talk in my classes, like, you know, people can really, really dislike U.S. policy, but they like Americans.
Sure.
And so the, in a certain sense, I feel like that might be some of the confusion of the term itself, too, is that it's really about people holding views about what the U.S. government is doing as opposed to the people that the, you know, U.S. citizens who are coming and visiting.
Yeah, I was just in Cuba for 2 weeks over the holidays. And the Cubans aren't, they're not the most open people talking politics for obvious reasons, right? But were incredibly friendly, incredibly warm. They were so happy to have more and more people from the States visiting Cuba. And so we might expect or associate or even just based on a survey think, okay, Cuba's full of anti-Americans. But the reality is so much more nuanced, right?
Yeah, and I think I found that all over the region is that I can't even think of a single example right now where somebody like automatically disliked me because I was from the United States. Though they had plenty to say about the Iraq war or war on terrorism or whatever the case might be. Now, getting to also the specifics of the article that you wrote, let's talk a little bit about what's the difference between anti-American opinion. So we'll just use the phrase, it's a common phrase, anti-American opinion between Latin American elites and the general public. And I want to follow up then thinking about public opinion, but how should we think about the difference between that elite and general public views?
Well, for looking specifically at like privately held opinions, it's hard to talk with much confidence about general elite tendencies. It's easier to talk about the masses because there's more survey data out there. There's not a
true
amount of elite survey data or even systematic qualitative research on the subject. But for the general public, we can say, as you mentioned, favorable views towards the U.S. are surprisingly widespread. Not even that, but they're even more widespread in countries with a history of U.S. interventionist foreign policy, right, which is surprising. And my argument, together with Andy Baker, is that it's, what's driving this is economic exchange. Those same countries, Guatemala, Dominican Republic, Panama, et cetera, that has a history of intervention and now have very favorable views, the same countries that are tied to the U.S. through trade, remittances, investment, and aid. And so when the average guy on the street thinks about the U.S. and his associations are shaped by what he sees the U.S. representing economically rather than with regards to foreign policy. But if we think specifically about the relationship between mass opinions and elite rhetoric, my paper for the Latin Americanist was motivated not just by the scarcity of analysis of the elites, but also by this puzzle of this apparent contrast between what the average citizens think of the U.S. and what we assume the average member of the political or society elite was writing or saying about the U.S. All right, and so again, the previous research says that the masses aren't necessarily so dependent on the elite as we might expect for their opinions, right? They're basing their opinions off objective experiences as consumers, recipients of remittances, with what the U.S. represents economically. But what about Latin American elites? Why are they, in fact, as anti-American as we assume? And if so, why are they preaching a message that goes against the views of their voters? All right, a lot of the political behavior literature sees elite rhetoric as reactive to public pressures. You take the positions that are common among your voters and your supporters. You don't want to run against the tide. And so my analysis of this question looks specifically at the region's political leaders, presidents, and sort of aspiring presidents, and concludes by looking at their rhetoric, first of all, that while not all leaders are following the lead of Chavez or Morales, there certainly isn't evidence, of regional elites stoking positive views of the U.S., right?
Right,
so there's nobody preaching the favorable view.
That's true.
And instead, some of the region's top politicians do frequently and directly criticize the U.S. And they're focusing on topics that their voters don't appear to give too much attention or importance. And so why is this? Well, if we break down presidential rhetoric by audience type, looking at where and to whom each particular speech was given, we see that attention to the U.S. both generally, but particularly for negative attention, negative rhetoric, is concentrated among speeches with an international audience. And so the voters aren't the target necessarily. Instead, the U.S. and its historical and current interventionism is being used as a focal point, I argue, by those who are in favor of deeper regional integration, those who want to beef up the mandate of UNASUR or CELAC or broaden the membership of ALBA.
A couple of things, actually, that you just made me think about was one, actually, I phrased the question kind of wrong because I was asking you about the opinion of elites, but as you say, we don't actually know the opinion of elites. We just know the rhetoric of elites. And so it's – and maybe I was even fallen into the trap of making the assumption that the rhetoric actually matches their opinion, which might not be true at all.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, too. I had never thought of trying to connect this to the public opinion literature, the behavior literature, a lot of which is American politics. Because it hadn't occurred to me that really – we sort of refer to the rhetoric of Hugo Chavez or Evo Morales or Correa or whomever, but there's not any systematic research done on that, is there?
Yeah, I had to rely a lot on the literature from U.S. politics, as you said, to the theoretical building blocks here. And so there really wasn't much out there on Latin American rhetoric. But I did approach it, as you say, as not assuming rhetoric and opinion were one and the same, and thinking more about the strategic motivations that, you know, why is a leader going to say what they do, when they do, and to what audience? It's certainly harder to dig beneath the surface and say, at the end of the day, what do you think in private?
And so do you think that we collectively, we have studied Latin America, but also, say, media in the U.S. that pays attention to Latin America, do you think we all just generally assume that the rhetoric that these leaders in Latin America are using matches their opinion? Because I feel like those things get conflated.
Yeah, I think particularly with Latin American leaders that we assume that, because there is a level of, we often use the term populism, but Latin American leaders love to give speeches. I mean, the average one does. And so I was wading through this stuff doing content analysis from Chile, Argentina, some from Colombia, Ecuador. The number of speeches is just ridiculous how often they're appearing in public. And so even me, I'm assuming at some level that when you talk enough, your general priorities are going to be fleshed out. But, I can't say with a degree of certainty that is the case, right? Because we're assuming something about privately held positions. I don't know if I'm answering your question while you're.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm sorry. I'm just thinking aloud, because the other thing that we often see is that people can give inflammatory speeches and then very privately go find quiet channels to actually talk to the U.S. about issues of mutual interest,
sure.
Which suggests that there's not necessarily an intense hatred there, but rather you're doing the you're having this rhetoric is trying to serve a particular political purpose.
And
so this was actually going to segue into the next question, and that is, what's the best way for us to figure out at any given time what audience elites are aiming the rhetoric at? I mean, I know that if you're at the UN and you're giving a speech, well, we kind of know your rhetoric, but is it just the medium and the location? Is that how we figure out who leaders are actually talking to?
Yeah. And so, quantitatively, I do code the speeches based on location and audience. But you're right that an international location doesn't mean that the speech couldn't be broadcast back at home to the domestic audience as well.
Yes, that's true. I'm looking tough something like that.
Yeah. And so there is evidence. So I looked at Correa and Ecuador in most depth. And this is the case I know best because I've spent about 3 years there and done a lot of field research. And there's some evidence that Correa, he's also targeting his domestic audience a little bit, but more sort of with a long-term vision to educate them and what he sees as the negative characteristics of the United States. And maybe that's with an eye towards making the U.S. an easier target to potentially scapegoat or use it as a distraction, something that seems to be in the playbook of Maduro, certainly, or Chavez before that, not to say that the U.S. isn't guilty of anything it's accused of. But if we look, if we just compare, looking based on audience type, where is the speech given, who is it given to, the degree, the difference in the level of attention given to the United States, and also the negativity of the content is remarkable. And so looking at both Correa, but also I did analysis of Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and it's a difference of something like 10 to 15 times more attention is given to the United States when that audience becomes international. And so there certainly is something at play there, even if we recognize that some of those speeches are broadcast back to domestic audiences.
And so we would have to speculate about whether the leaders are actually fully aware that the domestic audience is only partially interested in hearing an anti-U.S. message, right? Because presumably they're not going to try to drive something home too much to a domestic audience that holds an opposing view. Or is that, do you think that's a bad assumption?
I think that's partly true, but also, and this maybe goes against the importance of my research a little bit, but the more you look at public opinion in Latin America, the average Latin American doesn't give a ton of importance to foreign affairs. Now, you know, similar to the United States at some level, right? There's research to suggest that we don't care all that much about trade agreements, even if they're talked about a ton in the campaign. And so this gives the leaders a bit more leeway to have some sort of top-down proactive use of speech. Because even if they're disagreeing with their voters, taking a different position, they're not going to get a ton of pushback on average because while Latin Americans view the U.S. favorably on average, this isn't one of their most important issues. Right? They're thinking about job creation, thinking about security, they're thinking about corruption a lot more than they are thinking about how a leader talks about the states.
Yeah, and actually it's also possible that if a Latin American leader gives a speech with some anti-American rhetoric, that it's going to be covered a lot more in the United States than at home. Because the U.S. public likes to get outraged at what foreign leaders are saying about us.
Yeah.
Now, thinking again of speculatively, how likely do you think the Trump administration will change Latin American attitudes? Is this something that likely shifts with change of administration, or is it something that is not quickly changeable?
I mean, my research suggests that at a cross-national level, these gaps in attitudes from one country to the next have a lot to do with economic exchange. But if we look temporally, there's plenty of evidence that Latin American attitudes also reflect perceptions of current U.S. leaders and policies. So if we look at the Bush years, for example, after the invasion of Iraq in particular, there's a big fall in mass favorability in Latin America throughout the region, but particularly in countries such as Argentina and Uruguay without strong economic ties. With Trump, I expect a growth of negative opinions for a number of reasons. First, Trump has a unilateralist approach to foreign policy, sort of somewhat similar to George W. Bush, that doesn't play well with the public in Latin America and beyond. But second, there seems to be a certain degree of Latin American solidarity or collective identity in response to the threats and insults Trump has directed at Mexico. So when we look at Peru's Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, like a president who is in no way close to the ALBA camp, he's been very vocal in his criticism of Trump and in defense of Mexico. Right. So he's no Correa or Maduro that's going to be criticizing the U.S. vocally to begin with. And finally, look back at economic exchange. The Trump administration could both reduce the prominence of U.S. economic ties with Latin America through exiting the TPP, renegotiating NAFTA and the like, while also changing the information that is communicated by those economic ties. So, for example, a Colombian who immigrates to the States could spread positive associations with the U.S. by talking to his family members back in Colombia about economic opportunity or political stability, and sending money back then doesn't hurt either. But that same Colombian immigrant could easily spread negative associations by relaying stories of discrimination or an increasing risk of deportation. I expect it's these latter stories that are going to become more common under the Trump administration.
Yeah, and I mean, you could even get more concrete, which is that if you slap tariffs on a country or threaten to slap tariffs on a country, then the positive economic exchange is undermined, and that was what was undergirding a lot of the positive views, right?
Yeah, certainly, right? So Trump's arguing to put forth this 20% tax on tariffs from Mexico, and that's going to, it potentially would limit trade between the regions.
And so thinking back to one of the things you had said earlier, which is that we actually don't – we see some Latin American leaders who stir up anti-American or try to stir up anti-American sentiment with their rhetoric, but we just don't really ever see Latin American leaders stirring up pro-U.S. sentiment. And in a sense, often U.S. leaders make it really hard to do. Right. I mean, it's very hard for somebody to lean on the U.S. in any sort of way to say, oh, they're going to consistently do positive things for us. Sadly, over time, that seems to be the case anyway.
Yeah.
All right. We are out of time. I've been talking to Dave Kuperi.
Perfect.
Good. Who is an assistant professor of political science and public policy at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. And so also make sure to check out that special issue of the Latin Americanist. We got a number of articles on the topic of U.S.-Latin American relations generally. And so, Dave, thank you so much again.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.